This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to History That Doesn't Suck. I'm your professor, Greg Jackson, and I'd like to tell you a story. And more specifically, since today is December 25th, I'd like to tell you a Christmas story. We just happen to be at the point where George Washington crosses the Delaware River on Christmas Day, 1776, and I just couldn't resist giving you the gift of a little bonus Christmas episode. So grab another mug of eggnog and cozy on up by the fire that George's army sure wishes it had, because I'm about to tell you the heartwarming story of a surprise attack that will leave about 24 men dead, others injured, and over 900 as prisoners of war. It's like as touching as Charles Dickens, just deadlier. Here we go. It's December 1776, and George Washington's situation is dire. He's been pushed out of New York, through New Jersey, and across the frigid Delaware River into Pennsylvania, where he's using the ice-filled waters of the Delaware as a geographical buffer. When crossing the up to 800-foot-wide river in early December, George made sure his men cleared every single boat from its Jersey coast so that British generals Howe and Cornwallis couldn't follow. Well, that is, they couldn't follow without taking the time and effort to build rafts and boats themselves. So it's not much, but the Delaware River is providing some protection to George's meager force. And right now, he'll take anything he can get. See, many are coming to think the revolution is over. Like, game over. Congress has fled Philly. Some people in newly British-occupied New Jersey are considering the loyalty oath and the accompanying pardon that General Howe's offering. The soldiers formerly under the command of now-captured patriot General Lee leave a trail of blood behind them as they march. Why? Because their ill-shod feet are bleeding out on the frozen ground. Meanwhile, George Washington has a mere 3,000 or so frozen and hungry men with him on the Pennsylvania side of the Delaware. More are coming to meet up with him, but unless something changes, he won't have most of these troops for long. All save 1,400 Continental Army enlistments expire at the end of this month. And further, George figures that General Howe, over on the Jersey side of the Delaware, has a force numbering around something like 10,000. These are the times that try men's souls, Thomas Paine will write the following year. And he should know. He's joined the army and is one of the Patriot soldiers who just retreated across the Delaware. And yet, George is about to catch a break. General Howe spends roughly a week near the Delaware River, but he can't find an easy way to cross it. And, you know, it's super cold. So he decides the war is done for the winter. Now, if you think that sounds lazy or just plain stupid, you should know that suspending a war during winter is kind of a thing in 18th century Europe. It's considered a gentleman's way of fighting. War is awful enough, so no need to do it in the cold. There has to be a really compelling reason to keep going in the dead of winter, and that's something Howe just doesn't have. I mean, were you listening to what I said a minute ago? It sounds like this war is done, so why would he break with social norms? It's time to let the British Army breathe a little easier. General Clinton goes to Newport. General Howe heads back to New York with General Cornwallis. Once they get there, the plan is that Howe will hang out in the city while Cornwallis can go to England and see his wife. Sounds nice, right? Oh, and what's William Howe going to spend his winter doing? Well, if you believe the rhyme that caught on in the area, Sir William, he, snug as a flea, lay all this time a-snoring, nor dreamed of harm as he lay warm in bed with Mrs. Loring. Ah, yes. Remember, General William Howe is known for loving the pleasures of life almost as much as he is known for his bravery on the battlefield. And let's also keep in mind the relationship he struck up with the beautiful, blonde, blue-eyed Mrs. Loring back in Boston, with her husband's apparent consent, no less. And so, on December 14th, the day after the capture of Patriot General Charles Lee, General Howe heads back to New York. But wait, who's going to keep up the occupation of New Jersey? Why, the hired help, of course. I mean, this sounds like a crappy job, so they'll just pass the buck to the mercenaries, those Germanic soldiers, the Hessians. General Howe has them set up outposts in the Garden State. He knows they are spread a bit thin, but he's got to offer protection to all those New Jerseyans who took or are considering taking the oath of loyalty to King George. And besides, it's winter, and George is almost broken. This guy isn't a threat, right? Wrong. Really, really wrong. You know, you can say a lot of things about George. Many of his contemporaries sure did. But one thing I've always personally admired about George is he never quits. Never. He can be bruised, broken, have failed a million times over, but as long as he has a pulse, George will always get back up. It's almost like he thrives on difficult situations. He's at his best when the odds are the worst. When it's time for a clutch move in overtime, that's when George shines. After General Howe takes off, George's headcount starts to creep up. In addition to the 1,000 Pennsylvanians who've joined him since he first crossed the Delaware, General Sullivan shows up with Charles Lee's men on December 20th. They should have numbered roughly 4,000. Instead, their numbers are down to about 2,000. General, I have the best first name ever, Horatio Gates rolls in too. He has about 600 troops. At best, George now has 6,000 men who are fit to fight. How demoralizing. He was counting on both groups being bigger. But he's gearing up for the offensive, even if his force is smaller, hungrier, and colder than he would like. Really, George has little choice. And thankfully, his inner circle seems to get this too. In a letter to George dated December 22nd, Joseph Reed writes, quote, "We are all of opinion, my dear general, that something must be attempted. Even a failure cannot be more fatal than to remain in our present situation. In short, some enterprise must be undertaken in our present circumstance, or we must give up the cause." George, it seems, couldn't agree more. And without Charles Lee around, he's got a pretty reliable and loyal crew, which includes people like Henry I Read Books and Blow Things Up with Cannons Knox, and Colonel William Tudor, who writes to his fiancée on Christmas Eve to say, quote, "I cannot desert a man, George Washington, who has deserted everything to defend his country." So George decides he'll attack Trenton. It's a small town of about 100 homes on the Jersey side of the Delaware River that Colonel Johann Rahl and his three regiments, totaling roughly 1,500 Hessians, have turned into one of their winter outposts. Here's the plan. The Patriot Army will move out in three groups on Christmas night. Not Christmas Eve, I mean at night on December 25th. George Washington will lead the largest group. He's going to cross the Delaware about 9 miles upstream of Trenton, where you'd find McConkie's Ferry. After crossing at midnight, his men will then move south in two columns led by Generals Greene and Sullivan, respectively, though George is going to ride with Greene. Each group will also have four of Henry Knox's cannons at the head of their ranks and surprise attack the Hessians in the village from the north just before sunrise. Meanwhile, a second group of some 700 Pennsylvanians under the leadership of James Ewing will cross the river on the south side of Trenton and occupy the bridge that goes over the Assunpink Creek leading to Bordentown. This way, if the Hessians try to escape George's attack, they'll have to deal with James's crew. Lastly, a third group of 1,500 Pennsylvanians and Rhode Islanders mixed together, led by John Cadwallader and Joseph Reed, will cross even further south, at Bristol, and they'll deal with Bordentown. Okay, you ready for this? It's Christmas. Let's cross the Delaware for this not-so-holy night and see if the Hessians have been naughty or nice. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, oh, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. As night falls, it's even more frigid than usual. A nor'easter is moving in and freezing rain soaks the Patriot troops. Meanwhile, the river swells and is even wider than usual as large chunks of ice swirl about. Because of this weather, the two groups that are supposed to cross the Delaware further south of Georgia's 2,400 men fail to do so. This means there will be no one to stop Hessians from escaping south towards Bordentown, and George has no idea that this will be the case. As for George's group, they're crossing, but far slower than planned. Thankfully, they have the booming voice of Henry Knox, who can call out loudly enough for the men to actually hear their orders over the incoming storm. John Glover and his men from Marblehead, Massachusetts, row the army across in massive Durham boats. These things are up to 60 feet long and come to a point on both ends. The boats transport as many as 40 men at a time, all of them standing. Now, if you're thinking, whoa, hold up. That doesn't sound like the super famous painting I've seen of George Washington crossing the Delaware. That's because you're right. I'm talking about Emanuel Leutze's 1851 painting. Look, it's gorgeous. I love it. But it's not accurate. Those boats are way too small. And I don't think George would have been stupid enough to strike that very destabilizing but super hardcore pose in which Emanuel depicts him. I mean, don't you think he'd be a little too traumatized to stand in a precarious position while crossing an ice-filled river? Remember, two decades ago, he spent a wet and freezing night with Christopher Gist on an island in the middle of the Allegheny River after falling in while trying to cross it. It wasn't a good time. I have to wonder, standing on that Durham boat with large sheets of ice floating about, as the Marblehead men that are rowing George across are shoving them off, trying to push them away, did his mind go to that night that he spent out there freezing with Christopher Gist? I have to imagine it did. George is among the first to cross and gets to the Jersey side around 11 p.m., which is also about the time the nor'easter hits in full fury. Rain, snow, hail, you name it, it's coming down. The men try to warm themselves by fires as the crossing takes until 3 a.m., or in other words, a full 3 hours longer than it should have, than was planned. There's no way they'll make the 9-mile march to Trenton before daybreak. The storm has also rendered some of the men's muskets too wet to fire. And to make matters worse, George doesn't realize that none of the support from the other two groups he's counting on crossing south of Trenton are going to be there. Yet, George decides to push on anyhow. A Connecticut soldier named Elijah Botswick recalls marching through the snow and rain, lighting the way with torches that they stuck on the exalters of their 18 cannons. Meanwhile, George Washington called out to soldiers, trying to encourage them. He admonishes them, "For God's sake, keep by your officers!" Despite such calls and reminders, two tired troops fall behind and freeze to death. Finally, they arrive at Trenton just before 8 a.m. and a full hour after sunrise. The two columns move in fast. The column with George and Nathaniel Greene head down Pennington Road and open fire on Hessian guards. They in turn fall back, firing while retreating. At the same time, John Sullivan's column moved down River Road. As the Hessians in their black and blue uniforms pour out of houses and buildings, Henry Knox's cannon are ready and waiting for them on King and Queen Streets. Despite being weak with illness himself, artillery captain Alexander Hamilton leads his men at King Street. They perform admirably as a Hessian cannonball narrowly misses striking Alexander. He hears it whiz by his head. The Patriot cannons make the Hessians flee toward the side streets, where Sullivan's men greet them with bayonets fixed. Nasty hand-to-hand combat ensues as the Hessians try to level the playing field by bringing out a field gun on King Street. They never get a chance to use it. The teenage lieutenant and future fifth president of the United States, James Monroe, along with the commander-in-chief's relative, Captain William Washington, pounce on the field gun and turn it on the Hessians. And yes, by the way, in case you didn't pick it up, there are two future U.S. presidents in this battle. Amid the fighting, the Hessian commander, Colonel Rahl, takes a hit. It knocks him off his horse, and he dies from the wound the next day. Chased into an orchard, the Hessians realize they have nowhere to go, and so they surrender. The whole battle is over in no more than an hour. The victory is astounding. Different sources disagree on the exact casualty numbers, but roughly 24 Hessians are dead. The only Americans who died were the two that froze to death marching there that morning. The only American injuries were Captain William Washington and Lieutenant James Monroe, and one or two other enlisted men. Even more impressive, though, George has captured 6 German cannons and taken over 900 prisoners of war. Yeah, 900, you heard that right, 3 digits. A mere 400 to 500 Hessians in total escape. Now, a word deserves to be said in a defense of sorts for Colonel Johann Rahl. The dead make for good scapegoats because they generally don't talk back. He's court-martialed post-mortem years later in 1782. Truth is, he was diligent about keeping guards on the ready, probably more so than should have been expected. For example, only 4 days before the battle, he received a letter from his commanding officer telling him the Americans were, quote, "almost naked, dying of cold, without blankets, and very ill supplied with provisions," close quote. How worried would you be if you were him, getting that kind of note from your boss? Now that said, Johann did receive a warning about American troops moving on Christmas Day. It was the storm that convinced him things were fine with his usual level of security, though. He didn't think anyone would be crazy enough to go out in a nor'easter. What can I say? The colonel had not yet met George Washington. As for the accusation that Johann had gotten plastered the night before, in fact, that all of his troops had gotten plastered the night before, the accounts by George's men do not seem to indicate they found the Hessians drunk or hungover. So those accusations might well just be some after-the-fact unfounded gossip. But I'll tell you who did get plastered. Some of George Washington's men. After the battle, George discusses taking the fight to another Hessian post down at Burlington, New Jersey. He and his officers decide against it because the men are exhausted and, well, they've also found the Hessian stores of alcohol, and they've helped themselves. Hey, to be fair, they may have just saved the American Revolution. If any group deserves a drink, isn't it this group? Now, this victory cannot be understated. It restores the people's confidence in George that they'd lost after General Howe chased him from New York. And furthermore, over half of George's men choose to stay in the army as their enlistments expire. It's starting to look a little better for the Patriots. We'll talk more about George's upward momentum next time, but for now, Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and thanks as always for listening. History That Doesn't Suck is a bi-weekly podcast, normally, apart from these little special episodes that I guess I just set a precedent for. If you've enjoyed listening, though, please subscribe to ensure you don't miss future episodes. You can also find me on Instagram, Facebook, and as of this past week, Twitter. Just search for History That Doesn't Suck. And of course, if you'd like to help History That Doesn't Suck keep going, please share it with your friends or consider a $1 a month subscription at patreon.com/historythatdoesntsuck. As for next time, are you ready to say revolution in French? It's actually not hard. It's the same word, révolution. So, but at any rate, it's time to get the French involved. And I'm looking at you, Lafayette. So, join me in 2 weeks from now in episode 9, where I'd like to tell you a story.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.